Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief Mother Jones. His latest book is Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. You can learn more at motherjones.com and follow David on Twitter at DavidKornDC. David, C-O-R-N-D-C. Let me introduce this by saying I've been doing these conversations since the mid-90s when I took a hiatus in 2014, but since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week to deal with its causes, repercussions, and our response. This is the 39th such interview. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, David K. Johnston on the daily dirty work of the Trump administration, and an occasional reprieve from politics like Robert Wright on why he's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. Now, a quick plug for participation. I've been telling people ever since I started doing these new live shows about various ways they could get involved. At this point, the process of turning this country around means you have to volunteer between now and November 6th to send men and women to Washington who will stand up to Trump and stand up for the rule of law. Four sites I'll suggest to get you involved. IndivisibleGuide.com. That's one word, IndivisibleGuide.com. OurRevolution.com. That's the organization that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. One word, Our Revolution. And then MoveOn.org and in California, CourageCampaign.org. We have less than 2 weeks till the midterms. The U.S. government must stop acting as if the U.S. is made up solely of Trump's base. It is not. They are at most a third of the electorate. The rest of us need to so thoroughly repudiate them at every level on November 6th that the tables are finally turned. Let's rise up and reject the self-destruction of our nation's standing and ideals in such overwhelming numbers that the message gets through even to those who have so far embraced or enabled it. And then, of course, the real work begins. Now to today's guest, David Korn. As I said, it's less than 2 weeks until the midterms. One of the political comedy shows, I think it was Samantha Bee's, interviewed some regular folks about their plans to vote or not. One guy said he wouldn't be voting. He only voted in the real elections when we elect a president. Well, let me tell you, the Republicans love that guy. I don't have to tell you that November 6th is a real election. My guest today wrote the Mother Jones cover story, The Most Important Election of Our Lives. He has stated that the Russia scandal is the most important scandal in the history of the United States. And as I said, co-authored with Maisel Isikoff, the book Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. Who better to talk to at this moment? In addition to his role as Mother Jones Washington Bureau Chief, David Korn is an on-air analyst for MSNBC. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, Showdown, Hubris, that one again with Isikoff, and The Lies of George W. Bush, as well as the e-book, 47% Uncovering the Romney Video that rocked the 2012 election, and that particular report earned him the George Polk Award. Welcome, David Korn, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners as we start that we're recording this interview Wednesday, October 24th, 2018.
Good to be with you, Terrence.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we're going to talk about. So can you tell us a bit about your path to the work you do? How did your work evolve? When did you first get involved in journalism? And when did you first turn to politics?
Oh, gosh. How much time do you have? I was a Watergate baby. I was very young when Watergate was happening, and I quickly became a fan of the Washington Post duo, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, and the work they were doing, which seemed to be, you know, functioning as a check for accountability and truth against a political system that was having a hard time providing that. And from that point on, I kind of wanted to be a journalist. I thought it was neat because it lets you go anywhere and knock on someone's door, pick up the phone, call them, now email them, and ask questions. And you could be a curious busybody and get paid for that and have a reason to do it. And hopefully to do it in order to reveal truth and information that will lead to better outcomes in society, terms of politics and other policy matters. So I entered the world of journalism when I was in high school for my high school paper. I did it throughout college. I did it even before leaving college. And I've been doing it ever since. I worked for The Nation magazine for 20 years or so as a Washington correspondent. Then about 10 years ago, I shifted over to Mother Jones. They're opening a Washington, D.C. bureau. I became the bureau chief, and it's been growing over the last 10 years. We have 19 reporters, editors, office manager, and two fellows here in the D.C. bureau, one of the biggest bureaus in Washington. In terms of, magazines and newspapers, we certainly are bigger than the L.A. Times, Boston Globe, not as big as Washington Post, New York Times, Bloomberg, AP, Reuters. But, beyond those folks, we have a pretty big presence here, and we produce a daily website with breaking news and enterprise stories, investigative pieces every day. And Mother Jones still is a fashion magazine that comes out every other month, and we're very easy to find at motherjones.com.
Yeah, and although it has a .com, Mother Jones is a nonprofit or is funded by a nonprofit?
We're published by a nonprofit that's called the Foundation for National Progress. And it's very interesting because these days, for years, we've had a crisis in journalism with media outlets trying to figure out a business model that works with a collapse of advertising revenue that started with the expansion of the internet and online media. A lot of places are not making money or having trouble making money. It may just be in the world we live in at the moment that good, honest, digging journalism on serious matters is something akin to a museum, a ballet, a Philharmonic Orchestra. None of these things would exist without donations. They can't exist on a for-profit model. So we are a nonprofit, which means we get about half our revenue from advertising and subscriptions, email rentals, but we also get half of our money from donations. So that comes from our subscribers who donate above and beyond the cost of subscriptions, and some foundations and some big folks. But it's all very diverse. There's no one major backer behind Mother Jones, or even two or three. And that's a great model for independent investigative journalism, because we really have nobody who can tell us what to do except ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
And we, follow our own mission.
Yeah, I wanted to get that in there because although people probably are feeling right now very tapped out by political donations, Mother Jones, which breaks stories, which as you say, is one of the biggest bureaus in D.C., is a nonprofit and can use your support.
I'm glad you're saying that.
Yeah, I know. And I'm saying it during a fund drive at KPFK, also a nonprofit. Even you admit that we hear it almost every time. This is the most important election of our lives. First of all, I'm going to ask you two questions. Some of these recent elections have had some serious consequences, so they were not just blowing smoke when people said that. And then, so I want you to tell some of the just direct consequences of some recent elections, and then what's different this time?
Well, all elections have consequences, right? Well, Ronald Reagan got elected in 1980, and he gave us a gigantic tax cut, mainly for the wealthy, deregulated, sounds familiar, right, in terms of environmental safeguards, and really kind of try to shrink the social safety network and had some real impacts there. George W. Bush won a very close election, a contested election, in which he did not get a majority of the popular vote. Al Gore, of course, did, and it took the Supreme Court to get George W. Bush into the White House, and he launched a war that had tremendous consequences. Several thousand Americans were killed, tens of thousands were injured and maimed, and hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians, not combatants, lost their lives because of the war. And we that the war gave us ISIS and gave us a lot of the problems we still have today. So these elections obviously are highly, highly consequential, but midterm elections can be consequential as well. In 1994, 2 years after Bill Clinton won the presidency, with a somewhat progressive platform, Newt Gingrich and the Republicans won the midterm elections and took control of the House for the first time in, I don't know, about 40 years or so, whatever it was. And they really thwarted all the progressive elements of what had been Clinton's agenda. And he was able to pass things that were more conservative, like a crime bill and welfare reform, but completely failed on his goal of doing more in terms of health care issues. So we, come up to 2016, and obviously it's hard to think of a more consequential, brazen, blatant, bizarre choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. But, and we've seen consequences amazingly, more so than the Reagan election in terms of a tax cuts that blows up the deficit and only and favors the wealthy by tremendous margins. What he's doing, on the courts, and not just the Supreme Court, shoving lots of conservative justices onto the federal court at the district level and the appellate level. We've seen him pull out a climate change treaty, or try to. That's going to take a little while. It's not done yet. And now he's starting to pull out of an important arms control treaty, nuclear missiles, and Russia. So, tremendous consequences, and we see this tremendous coarsening of the political discourse, which really is coming from Trump himself. But beyond that, why I wrote a piece of Mother Jones, and I said this somewhat cheekily, although I think you can say, you can make the case that this is the most important election in our lifetime, is that Trump has behaved in a way that is not normal. He has, as I just said a moment ago, coarsened the political discourse, but he has attacked the media, and as we're talking, there is a bomb threat at CNN.
Mm-hmm.
He has violated all sorts of norms, chanting, encouraging the chants of lock her up regarding Hillary Clinton, which is a banana republic type of thing to do. He has shown no loyalty at all, even marginally so, to truth and accuracy. The fact checker, the Washington Post, Glenn Kessler, 18 months into Trump's presidency a few weeks ago, noted that he had chronicled 5,001 false statements or lies from Trump. I wrote a book in the early 2000s called The Lies of George W. Bush, when I thought George W. Bush was pushing the envelope. But he was a piker compared to Trump.
Yep.
And, and then we have, all these corruption issues. Trump making money in his properties off Saudi customers, the Trump Hotel, the issue with the monuments, the issue with Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, and nepotism and maybe kleptocracy. Of course, my big issue, the Russian scandal. It's quite clear to me that Trump colluded with Moscow in at least this way during the 2016 campaign and afterwards. He has helped Putin cover up what Putin did. Putin keeps denying he did it. And in 2016 and even, in recent months, Trump amplifies and echoes Putin's own denials. So he is, in a way, helping and boosting the Kremlin cover-up, let alone whether there was any true conspiracy between the Trump team and the Kremlin as they were attacking a U.S. election in 2016. And certainly Trump has taken no steps and has not prioritized the idea of safeguarding our elections from Russian intervention this year or intervention from other parties. In fact, the Justice Department just a few days ago indicted a Russian accountant who was involved with the Russian attack on the 2016 elections and noted that this attack, this project that Russia has, is ongoing and is targeting the midterms right now, weeks before Election Day. And has Trump said anything about that? No, not at all. So a lot of these issues that I'm raising here are not partisan issues. They're not they're not traditionally Democratic versus Republican, liberal versus conservative, left versus right. Protecting the nation's electoral system from outside intervention is not a left-right issue. Being civil, not chanting lock her up, is not a left-right issue. Having a government in which the people at the top, including the president, are not banking dollars from governments that you have to engage with, that's not a left-right issue. Lying shouldn't be a left-right issue. Honoring treaties, not necessarily a left-right issue. So his attack on the norms of government, on the traditional norms of political discourse, are not ideological. We're talking about issues of truth and accountability. And the last time I checked, neither one of those come with a D or an R afterward. And right? It's, so while people voted for Trump in 2016, perhaps not knowing exactly the path he would take or not believing he would take the path he seemed to be advocating, or wanted just to give an outsider who was angry and they were angry a shot, those folks. Well, now there's no question of who and what Trump is. So if we have an election day that ends up ratifying Trump, what will happen is truth and accountability will lose. Trump will be emboldened, and just as important, if not more important, all the Republicans who have enabled him by turning into a cult of personality will learn that there is no price to be paid for this sort of behavior. There is no consequence. And if we reach that point in our democracy, I don't like to be gloomy and doomy here, but it will mark a moment, I think, of profound trouble for us as a republic.
You're right. Let me just paraphrase very briefly, but okay, one may not like the tax cut. One may not like the sabotage of health care. One may not like the judges, but leaving all that aside, those are the partisan issues. Those are the ideological issues. But the issues that you're saying, which undermine the Constitution, undermine the role of government, undermine the role of the free press, those are not partisan issues. Those are issues of civics, if you will, issues of running a country that in any way aspires to its own ideals. That is what you're saying is up for vote November 6th. And if the vote if there is not the repudiation, which I called for, which you called for, of this behavior, then it is approval. And at that point, the consequences, I think, mount in a way that may not be we may not even know at this point. Would that be a fair summation?
That's a fair summation. Let me just point out that Mother Jones Magazine, where I work, is a nonprofit, and we do not endorse candidates or political parties. So what? So I'm not calling for anything. I am just observing if the Republicans maintain control of Congress, this is how it will be viewed. I mean, we live in a country that is divided along a lot of different political lines, but we do need to have some rules of the road for our community, because we are still all Americans. We still share the nation. We share our government and our state governments and our local governments. And if you have somebody or a side that doesn't respect that fundamental fact, and doesn't adhere to, if not, you know, some of the traditional rules. I mean, what we're finding, a lot of this stuff is not written in stone. It's not written down. But if you have a president out there who is only campaigning or speaking to 33% of the public and hoping to pick up a few more because they don't want to vote for the Democrats and feels, you know, unencumbered in terms of praising authoritarian dictators overseas and attacking the free media here, calling it the enemy of the people, it's hard to have honest debates. You can't have honest debates about what to do if somebody is making stuff up. You know, Trump saying just this week, well, the caravan coming up from Central America, which he's turned into a demagogue over, it may have Middle Easterners and maybe terrorists. And then they ask, what's the proof? He goes, oh, there's no proof. I just said there might be, you know, and, you know, could be. I don't know. I mean, you can't have an honest policy debate if you have someone who has no concern for facts or accuracy. And also somebody who just literally does not believe in truth, and who, when he and his gang or party so blatantly disregard the truth, there's no accountability. And we have a Congress now that refuses to investigate anything. I mean, literally half of Trump's cabinet have engaged in ethics violations that, you know, are perfectly suitable targets for a congressional investigation. You know, as, you know, are, you know, the Trump Foundation, which might have engaged in criminal behavior. I mean, there's so much happening day in, day out, and the, you know, and the Republicans have completely abdicated any oversight role, any accountability. That's also bad for our system.
David, for anyone who hasn't heard about it, tell us about the list circulating within Republican circles in Washington that listed, to jump off of one of the points you made, that listed the possible probes Democrats might launch if they became the majority in the House.
Yeah, this was several weeks ago. Axios reported there was a spreadsheet going around Republican circles. Now, I mean, of possible lines of inquiry or investigations for the Democrats should they gain control of Congress. If they gain control of the House of Representatives, that is, they gain control of committees, and if you control the committees, you can launch probes and investigations. You cannot do that when you're in the minority, as the Democrats are now in both the House and the Senate. And, you know, the list is long. The list is obvious. The Trump taxes, emoluments, Trump, you know, organization making money from foreign governments while Trump continues to own the Trump organization. It's not really in a true blind trust. You have security clearance issues with Jared Kushner. You have business, you know, you have an intersection of business interests and in what he's doing in the White House as well. As I said a moment ago, a number of cabinet members can be investigated for a number of things. So it's, you know, the Democrats, should they gain control of the House, are going to have to be wise in choosing which things to investigate, because literally, I think you could come up with at least two dozen possible legitimate targets of investigation, and proceeding with all of them may lead to even too much chaos for the system to bear.
So. If the Democrats take over only the House, we can expect investigations, we can expect that sort of thing. If they were to win the Senate, which is a much longer shot, and one of the reasons for listeners is that every House seat is open every 2 years, But the Senate is staggered, and it just happens that the Democratic Party was, if you will, defending more seats in the Senate than the Republicans. That is to say, more seats held by Democrats were up for election this particular term. But if they were to win the Senate, what might that open up the opportunity for?
Well, again, the Senate committees could proceed with investigations, too. You could even maybe divvy them up between the House and the Senate. And one thing I would note is that the House Republicans essentially shut down the Trump-Russia investigation. That would be, I think, on the top of the list to reopen. I know that Congressman Adam Schiff, the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, that is the top Democrat on the committee at the moment, would most likely become chairman if the Democrats win. And he has a lot of lines of inquiry that he would like to revive if he becomes chairman of the committee. But if you gain control of the Senate, then you can, the Democrats will be in a position, of course, to block the confirmation of judges, Supreme Court justice nominees, should there be any, and other appointees. And you would have a situation where the Senate and the House could pass legislation if the Democrats, you know, say on health care, protecting pre-existing conditions, maybe climate change, maybe a middle-class tax cut that actually is a middle-class tax cut, and raising rates on Republican, excuse me, that was a Freudian slip. Raising rates on the wealthy. And, you know, Trump would probably veto a lot of this stuff, but it would set up the 2020 election if Trump is running for re-election. And he has just spent 2 years vetoing tax cuts for working Americans, workplace safety rules, health care protections, you know, whatever the Democrats want to try to pass. If they control both houses, they can come up with legislation, pass it, and send it to Trump. And that would put him in a box. And, of course, they would be loath and disinclined to pass measures that that he sent them.
Right.
And they would no doubt be, as they would if the House becomes democratically controlled, a tremendous amount of gridlock in Washington about budget matters and spending bills, things that have to pass to keep government working.
Okay. This is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief Mother Jones. His latest book, written with Michael Isikoff, is Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. You can learn more at motherjones.com, and you can follow David on Twitter at DavidKornDC. David, and then Korn is C-O-R-N, DavidKornDC. Let's turn to Russia. First question, do we have any idea when to expect Mueller's findings? And let's make clear to listeners that there is no requirement that the Mueller investigation produce an official report or that the American citizenry ever see one.
I mean, that's an important thing to keep in mind, because a lot of people talk about, when are we going to get the Mueller report? There may never be a Mueller report. You know, he is appointed pursuant to Justice Department rules regarding a special counsel. And under those rules, he's just obligated, when he basically finishes, to send a memo to the Attorney General. In this case, since Jeff Sessions is recused, it'd go to the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, or whoever might replace him if he doesn't stick around, explaining his prosecutorial decisions. Now, that memo could be 2 pages long. You know, here are the cases I brought and why, and or it could be 2,000 pages long.
Yeah.
Let me tell you all the things all the things I investigated and why we did not bring prosecutions in these cases. Now, that report doesn't have to be public. It could be made public by the Justice Department or not, and members of Congress, you know, could demand to see the report and make it public or leak it, so it may or may not come out. But you know, the important thing to remember is that Mueller's job is not to provide a full accounting of the Trump-Russia scandal. His job is to look for possible crimes and bring cases that he has a reasonable belief can win over a jury. And the information that he finds is gathered under what's called the grand jury rules. And under grand jury rules, you're not allowed to make anything public unless it's in an indictment or related to an indictment or evidence presented at trial. So he might find, I'm just being totally speculative here, information about a Trump financial action that involves Russian parties that Trump has never told anything of, told the public about, but if there's nothing criminal about it, it is not something that Mueller necessarily will be able to disclose to the public. This is why having decent congressional investigations or an independent commission was necessary or needed. Because that the goal of a project like that would be to investigate fully, like the 9/11 Commission did, and produce a report that tells everybody what happened. So the other question is, what Mueller might do if on the issue of Trump obstruction of justice. The question is, can a special counsel, can an employee of the Justice Department indict a sitting president? The Justice Department in the past has taken the position that can't happen, but other legal scholars beg to differ, and we don't know how Mueller sees this. But it's quite possible that if he believes there is evidence that Trump engaged in obstruction of justice, he might assemble that evidence, probably in a report of some kind, and give it to Congress, which is what Kenneth Starr did in the Monica Lewinsky investigation. He did not indict Bill Clinton for that. He believed Bill Clinton broke the law in ways that he thought merited impeachment, and he gave all the evidence and a long, overly detailed report to Republicans who controlled Congress at the time so they could then decide whether they should begin impeachment proceedings. So Mueller might take that path if he believes, if he has evidence that Trump engaged in obstruction. And that report, again, doesn't have to be public. Republicans made the Monica Lewinsky report public, and it ended up backfiring on them in many ways. Who knows what would happen this time around if there even was such a report. So we don't know what the end product is going to be of the Mueller investigation. We don't even know what the full boundaries are. You may be looking at episodes and people and connections that have not been in the public eye at all. And we don't know when he's going to finish. You know, Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, keeps coming and saying it's going to be done soon, done soon. Well, only in the last couple of weeks has Mueller been able to sit down with Michael Cohen, president's former lawyer, and Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign chair, who both, I mean, this is, take a step back. Both of these men have pleaded guilty.
That's right.
To crimes.
They have already pleaded
Michael
guilty.
Michael Cohen in his plea said, in essence, that he was a part of a conspiracy with Donald Trump in committing the crime that he pled guilty to. So these folks are just sitting down with Mueller and his investigators and could well provide leads that could lead to months, if not another year or two, of investigation, Mueller.
Right. There is no timeline. There is no time at which he has to deliver his findings or his, well, there isn't a report, so his findings. Now, some of these investigations, similar investigations, have gone on for multiple years. So this notion that it should have been done by the midterms or it should be, that's just spin, right? I mean, was it the Iran-Contra that took 6 years?
The independent counsel, Lawrence Walsh, who investigated Iran-Contra, took 6 years to finish that investigation.
Yeah.
You know, Mueller's been at this, you know, about a year and a half now. He's had tremendous number of convictions and indictments. He's been very productive, and he's moved in terms of these type of investigations relatively quickly. So all those Republicans saying it's time to wrap up or it's taking too long have no basis for saying that other than they want him to stop. I mean, there's no reason to say this is dragging on and taking too long other than the fact that they think it's a drag on the president. And I can understand that. You know, the election was tainted by the Russian intervention. There was contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia while Russia was attacking the United States. And, it's not a good look
for
Donald Trump.
And they also depend on the fact that the public doesn't know, most of the general public does not know what we've just said in the last 5 to 10 minutes about the scope of the investigation or the history of previous investigations. So they saw the House committee was able to wrap up quickly. Let's get moving on this. And people's ignorance allows that to have at least some weight. Now, I want to emphasize at this point, David, your critical point, which I think you raise in the book, you raise in talking about the book, and in most of your discussions, which is that even if there was no coordinated collusion prior to the election, and even if there is no criminal action up to that point by the Trump campaign, the behavior of Trump and his people once the investigation became, Moscow's actions became public, that rises, in your sense, to the level of negligence of duty, not upholding the Constitution, etc. Very serious things. The fact that Trump and his people promoted Moscow's claims of innocence even after, I'm quoting you here, U.S. intelligence officials briefed him in mid-summer 2016 that Russia was waging cyber and information warfare against the United States and its election. Even after being briefed and knowing that was the truth, he went into rallies and in debates claiming, as he still does, that Moscow was innocent.
I mean, this is a key point. Most listeners will have heard of the Trump Tower meeting, which happened on June 9th, 2016. That was the meeting between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort, then the campaign chairman. These are the three top people in the Trump campaign universe at that point in time. And two of the three are family members who are Trump's, you know, key advisors. They are meeting with a Russian emissary who they are told is bringing them dirt on Hillary Clinton. Now, the real key thing here is that the emails that set up this meeting said that this transmission of dirt was part of a Kremlin project to secretly help Trump. So they're being told the Kremlin wants to help Trump secretly. And they say, sure, Donald Trump's words, you know, precise words are, if this is what it seems to be, I love it. I love it.
And that's Donald Donald Trump Jr., right?
Jr., excuse me.
Yeah.
So they agree at that point in time to conspire with a Russian conspiracy. This in itself is collusion. They say that nothing came out of this meeting. Well, okay, attempted collusion. But it is collusion. But also what it does is it sent a signal to Moscow that the Trump campaign was okay with this. They didn't say, no, we're going to blow the whistle on you and tell the FBI that you're up to no good and trying to intervene in the election. They did none of that. They said to the Russians, we love it. Whatever you're doing to help us, we love it. So right then and then, you're basically giving them the green light, okay, even if you're not coming up with a joint plan. So if it's true that nothing comes out of this meeting, that's not the end of it. 5 days after this meeting, the National Committee reveals that it's been hacked, email stolen, documents pilfered, and that Russian hackers are the perps here, according to cyber experts. And the first thing that the Trump campaign says in response the next day, is this is a hoax. The DNC is making this all up. Wait a second. The Trump campaign, Trump Jr., Kushner, and Manafort, more than anybody else in the universe, any other American at least, had reason to believe that Russia was trying to interfere with the election. And if they were caught breaking into the DNC, well, maybe that was connected to what they had told the Trump campaign. But instead of saying anything along those lines, they accused the DNC of making this up. And then in July, the next month, 2016, when WikiLeaks releases 22,000 emails and documents stolen by the Russians, and it's all over the media that the Russians are the key suspects, Manafort and Trump Jr. go on TV and say there's nothing to this. The Clinton campaign is making it up. How dare they suggest Russia is getting involved in helping our campaign? Again, they knew that the Russians wanted to do this. Then you have incidents like that throughout the campaign. You have Trump being briefed, as you know, by U.S. intelligence in mid-August and being told the Russians are doing this. And he comes out for the next 6 weeks or 10 weeks through the course of the election and says, there's no reason to believe it's the Russians. It could be a 400-pound guy in a basement.
Yep.
So what was Putin saying at the time? Putin was saying, it's not us. We're not doing this. And so Trump was amplifying, echoing Russian propaganda. And the metaphor that I've used a lot here, for analogy, is imagine a guy on a street corner in front of a bank. The bank's being robbed. He's told the bank is being robbed. He can look around and see guys with masks and guns inside the bank. But when people walk by and say, what's up? He goes, nothing. There's no bank robbery here. Move along. Now, that guy is helping the bank robbers pull off the job, even if he wasn't part of the original caper. And in this case, the case of the Russian intervention, the bad guys, the evildoers, the wrongdoers, are engaged in this activity to help Trump.
And let me. I'm going to read another quote of yours, which is one I share. And you say quite simply, this is a violation of his oath to defend the United States. This is after he's president, because he has continued. Of course, everyone knows this. His response to this actions that have already interfered with an American election and are and there was a we can talk in a second about the. Eastern District of Virginia criminal complaint accusing a Russian national of conspiring to interfere in the U.S. political system in the upcoming midterms, 2 weeks from now. And so this the patriotic or even the constitutional action of a president when the U.S. is cyber attacked like this would be to defend the United States. And he views it simply as an attack on himself and his administration, and so consistently, despite his knowledge, says that this is not happening. This is a hoax, a witch hunt. You say this is a violation of his oath to defend the United States. He is guilty of outright negligence. Why? I think one of the things that troubles me is that Your position on this makes very good sense to me, and yet it seems that the media, even the media who Trump views as the enemy because he doesn't feel they're on his side, have gotten sidetracked by accepting Trump's framing of that if there's no absolute crime, then there's nothing wrong, rather than, it seems to me, they've also what I would say, his framing that this is an attack on Trump, not an attack on the United States.
It seems to me that he hasn't fulfilled his duty to defend the country because he hasn't fully acknowledged what happened or what his own Justice Department now says is still underway, Russian intervention in midterm elections. We haven't seen it. We don't know what that means. The Justice Department hasn't explained what it's meant by what it came out and mentioned in an indictment a couple of days ago. And the framing of this was that Trump just kept saying there's no collusion, no collusion, and he defined collusion as basically him sitting down with Russians and plotting out which DNC emails to take and when to release them.
Right.
I mean, he did call on the Russians during the campaign to hack Hillary Clinton's email and do whatever they could. But his definition of collusion is not the only definition of collusion. And collusion is not even a real, it's not a criminal matter. It's either conspiracy or not.
Right.
It's not, collusion is not a legal term. It can be whatever you want it to be. And I do believe that the tribalized divisive politics we have allowed him to get away with setting the terms for this discussion that seemingly benefit him and absolve him of the collusion that I just described, which in and of itself I think is a tremendous scandal that should have been investigated by Congress and others. It was never part of the congressional investigation, how he echoed and amplified Russian propaganda to protect the Russian, to basically help the Russians camouflage their attack on the United States. I sometimes, Terrence, feel a little bit like the crazy guy in the soapbox.
Yep.
It seems so clear to me that this is far worse in a way than anything Nixon might have done, which was just about winning, some political skullduggery at home. And Trump has never really been held to account for this. He obviously won the election, or at least, in a way won the election,
right.
won the Electoral College.
That's right.
Right. And won the White House and has escaped all accountability for this behavior, which is quite scandalous. Other people call it treasonous, traitorous. I don't know. It's not up to me to use words like that. But to me, it's quite scandalous. And I do think the media, which did not cover the Russian intervention sufficiently during the course of the campaign, and then afterwards was kind of slow to do anything until the Steele memos became public, and that created a something of a golden shower scandal.
Yeah,
has not framed the story correctly, and now even though my pals at the New York Times and Washington Post, at CNN, NBC do great stories on different elements of the Russian scandal, the story gets reported in a very kind of helter-skelter way. There's a scoop here, a scoop there, a scoop there. They're not chronological. They don't build a narrative, and it's hard for the public to follow, which is one reason why Michael Isikoff and I wanted to write the book Russian Roulette, to give everybody a sense of cosmos of this scandal, so when things happen, they can figure out where they fit. In the big picture, but the big picture, which includes Trump's misdeeds during the 2016 election and afterwards, I think tends to get lost in the overall shuffle of the news these days, but also in the complexity of the scandal and in all the sort of distractions, like will Trump fire Rod Rosenstein?
Right,
or,
right.
You know, what's up with Mueller? We're going to get the Mueller report, which may or may not come. And it's, you know, and Trump has been able to throw about a lot of shiny objects to keep people from focusing on some of the core central issues and principles of the scandal.
Okay, let me read, actually, I'm going to read a couple of things here. This is from the DOJ, which is, at this point, Trump's Department of Justice, if you will. I mentioned the criminal complaint accusing a Russian national conspiring to interfere in the U.S. political system. The DOJ contends the strategic goal of the Russian operation is to sow division and discord in the U.S. political system, including by creating social and political polarization, undermining faith in democratic institutions, influencing U.S. elections, including the upcoming 2018 midterms. The Russian operation aimed to inflame passions on a wide variety of topics. And, I mean, it's amazing. I read this and I thought, this is exactly what's going on in society. The fact that the Russians, you know, have a role in inflaming it is amazing. Immigration, gun control, Second Amendment, Confederate flag, race relations, LGBT issues, the Women's March, the NFL national anthem debate, all these things are, this is in the Department of Justice complaint claiming this is what the Russian operation is aiming to do. I share your both frustration and incredulity that this is not this attack on the United States, and they have also the intelligence has revealed that they have penetrated state election systems, and that they have I'm not sure how far they got on the grid, but that they have they have intention at least or explored the possibility of interfering the grid. That this isn't what people focus on, but that they focus on somehow it's all about getting Trump. And it strikes me that this is, just dereliction of the media's duty. And I understand when you say it's understandable because news focuses on today's news, today's story, today's scoop. That's what seems to be what gets people rather than the deeper question of what's happening between Russia and the United States.
Well, I think that's always the case, and you know we've seen good coverage of some of the cyber vulnerabilities of the United States, but it's not something that Trump seems to want to talk about. And if you don't have the leaders of the country, that includes people in Congress too, making an issue out of something quite regularly, it does get lost. I mean, a lot of Americans, it's understandable that their top concerns are about health care, education for their family, the wages they're bringing in, things like that. And to get people to sort of care about the security of elections or matters like voter suppression, which is related to this, issues of gerrymandering, just issues of democratic integrity, what some people might call process issues, has always been a bit difficult. And I think that's where you need leadership who, people, candidates, elected officials, others, influential folks who can make the connection between protecting the election system, keeping it free of outside intervention, and keeping it free of corruption, be it from the outside or be it from an overflow of special interest money, that you need that in order to get the best outcomes, the best policy outcomes to help you at home.
You said kitchen table issues, which is what a lot of people are concerned with, cannot be fully addressed if the house burns down. And by that you mean if the whole political process and the government is undermined, those kitchen table issues are not going to be dealt with as they should be.
They will not be dealt fairly and with the right deliberation. If you have a Congress that's awash with special interest money, the special interests will be the priority, and people who need help or with education or need protection with pre-existing conditions are not going to be at the top of anyone's to-do list. And if you have a system in which the election is being, I don't want to say rigged, but influenced by outside parties, once again, you're not going to have a majority will manifested in the election results. If the intervention is serious enough, and therefore you will not have a system that adheres to people representing a majority of Americans.
Yeah.
So these are all, I think, rather profound matters with tremendously deep consequences, but I understand why sometimes they're seen as secondary. And I've talked to a bunch of Democrats, running in House elections, and competitive elections, and by and large, they're not being asked a lot about Russia or even about Trump by the voters who they meet, and they're not talking a lot about that. It's like the Trump thing is baked into the cake. Everybody knows, everybody has an opinion about Trump and his behavior and conduct or misconduct, however you want to call it. And so they're not running around and saying, you must vote for me to beat back Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, at least in the Democratic message at the local level, I think it's just inherent. It's obvious.
Yeah.
If people
yeah.
are motivated to vote, they're motivated to vote because they see what's happening in Trump's America. And they are trying to connect with voters on local issues. And they may be land use issues for farmers. They
right,
may be
right.
subsidies and tariff issues for families. It may be, health care, which I mentioned. And they're trying to find a way. And I understand that.
Yep.
And you have a lot of people these days running around saying, there's no big message from the Democrats. The Democrats don't have a message. They suck. And I go, well, whether or not they suck, the Democrats for a midterm election don't necessarily need an overarching message. You need credible and competent candidates who are able to figure out how to win their seats the best way possible, given the local demands. And, it's true, we are not a parliamentary system where, one party puts out a platform.
Right.
And if it wins, it wins the legislature and takes over government. We are a much different system where, particularly in the midterm elections, the results are an amalgamation of a lot of different local elections. When I say different, they can be very different depending where they take place and who the candidates are. And that's frustrating for people who often have a national perspective. I work for a national magazine. You have a show that goes national. We watch cable news, which has a national perspective. And there's nothing wrong with all that. But a lot of what happens politically in this country happens outside of that national context.
Okay, we've got to bring it to a close, David. Thank you so much. So again, you can learn more at motherjones.com. You can follow David on Twitter at David Corn DC. David, C-O-R-N, Corn, David Corn DC. His latest book is Russian Roulette. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. You can receive a weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, plus 7 or 8 articles of relevance for that week. You can sign up at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, or you can email me at TEMcNally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, and that includes all the people you've heard over the years. Robert Reich, Naomi Klein, Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Connie Rice, Van Jones, etc. Thanks to Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos and Progressive Voices, and most of all you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, David Korn. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.